Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
I was in a band called Part Man, Part Horse, and that's where the idea started. I remember I was talking to one of my friends about my band and how I was able to, through other people I played music with, connect my band to my friends' bands, and we started kind of diagramming them out like a 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon kind of a thing, just to see like how we were all connected.
It's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is Rachel Ratner. We talked over Skype.
And then I started like getting more and more obsessed with the idea, and so then I had these like legal pads with like band names kind of scrawled on them, connecting to each other, and pretty soon I had a couple hundred just like local bands all through shared band members. I thought it was like pretty neat.
These days, Rachel is in a band called Wimps. She's also a software engineer and a brand new mother. You might hear a little Hazel in the background there. But most importantly for our purposes, Rachel is the creator of the Seattle Band Map.
I showed it to my friend Keith Whiteman, who is an artist, and he thought it would be neat to make it into an actual art show, like an art project. So he took it, my little paper-sized map, and he blew it up huge. He made it, it was like 10 feet by 10 feet. So we invited people down. This was in November of 2009, both to come view it and to come add to it. It became a really neat interactive kind of art show where just over that weekend, like 600 new bands were added, and it was really exciting to see because you would sit back and you would watch people looking at the map together, and then they started talking to each other about those bands and maybe reminiscing about shows they'd been to together or reminding each other about things they'd forgotten. So it really kind of brought people together.
With hundreds of people adding their bands to the map with Sharpies, the 10 by 10 sheet of vinyl started getting quite crowded. So in 2011, Rachel took the Seattle Band Map online.
It's pretty sparse. It's like a kind of a white page. And then in the middle, there's like the map, which is just a million tiny points, little lines between them, kind of zoomed out like a constellation. And so you can see all these points, which are bands. And then as you click on one or you zoom in, it brings up the band name, who's in it, and like who it's connected to.
So have you discovered any fun kind of 6 degrees of separation relationships among bands that you could relay?
Yeah. Taco Cat's a band that's been playing quite a lot recently. And kind of going through it, I was able to connect them all the way back to Green Day, which is a much larger band that's also a punk band. That's one of their influences. So it's kind of neat to see how they could actually be connected to a band that influenced them.
Oh, interesting. So their lineage through again, humans, they actually do have connection to them.
Which they didn't realize. So like one of their members played in a band who was connected to a band called See Me River, who was connected to a band called Duchess and the Duke, who was connected to a band called The Intelligence. And through that, there was a connection to The Shins, who are much larger. And through The Shins, there was a connection to Modest Mouse. There was a connection to a band called Jawbreaker. And through that, there was a connection to Green Day. So they were able to go, even though they themselves didn't know anybody in Green Day, through the 6 degrees of separation, they were able to be connected back to one of their influences. So I thought that was pretty neat. I think it was just eye-opening to see how everyone's related and how we're all kind of doing the same thing. But when I look at this, I look at this more like times in my life, people I knew, friendships I've had, you know, because I'm like, oh, I'm connected to Part Man, Part Horse, and I'm still friends with Gary and Lisa and Marshall in that band, and they just came over and met my daughter. So it's kind of like these are connections, but these are also like, you know, friendships and people in my life. I think I'm just going to keep it around as long as people are interested in it. People still seem to want to look at it and ask about it, and I'm still getting people adding bands to it all the time. So it's still kind of a living thing. So I think it doesn't have an end right now.
The map has over 6,000 bands on it at last count. It's still morphing and evolving, just like the musicians who use it to chart their own journeys from one band to the next. Which brings us to today's theme, A Work in Progress, stories of unfinished projects and people on today's episode of Sound Effect. Back in 1988, the Seattle School District had a problem on its hands. Black third graders were underperforming their white classmates in reading by 29 percentage points. It was a glaring inequality, and it was getting attention. That's the year that Keisha Scarlett started at Garfield High School in Seattle. Today, Keisha is still at Seattle Public Schools, and so is the disparity. In fact, the race gap has gotten bigger. Keisha is helping lead the district's charge to close that gap and lift up kids of color, and her approach is informed by her own experience as a black student in Seattle, especially her years at Garfield. KNKX's Ashley Gross spent some time with Keisha, who's now the district's chief of equity, and she found that overcoming those inequalities is still very much a work in progress.
Garfield High School does not look much like it did when Keisha began ninth grade here in 1988. It's been remodeled. The mural where she and her friends used to hang out is long gone.
I'm kind of surprised they painted over the Transformer, but that was just like a spot. The Transformer little toy, you know, it was like a robot. It was Optimus Prime.
But beyond what the school looked like and what was painted on the walls, Keisha remembers how Garfield functioned as a giant sorting machine. Black students went into one classroom, white students into another.
So you go down here, they had foreign languages right here. So, like, this was the Spanish class that I love so much. And all the white kids were going to Latin. All the black kids were going to Spanish, or maybe a little integration in French.
Keisha Scarlett is a tall woman. She's just a quarter inch shy of 6 feet. She's got a big smile and a quick laugh. But her very first day at Garfield as a ninth grader was not something to laugh about. Keisha was one of the only black students in the advanced learning track at Garfield. Full of first day anticipation, she walked into her honors language arts class and took a seat near the front. All around her, white kids were shuffling in. This is the end of the 80s, so think permed hair, acid washed jeans. Her teacher came over to her and asked to see her schedule.
I was like, why? And she's like, I just want to see your schedule. And I said, are you checking everyone's schedule? And she was like, what? And I was like, well, how about you check all of those people's schedules, and then you come back to me and check my schedule.
That response, let's just say that did not go over so well. They got in an argument. Her teacher told her she had to leave.
And I was like, why? Because I won't give you my schedule. And she was like, you need to get out because you're arrogant and uncooperative. And I'm not having this. We're not starting off the school year like this. I remember her saying, call me arrogant and uncooperative. You need to get out.
First period of the first day of school, Keisha and her teacher walk to the attendance office, where the teacher tells the secretary Keisha has been disrespectful. The secretary happens to know her older brother and sister.
She said, you're Kimberly and Maynard's sister? And I said, yes. She said, it's already first period and you're getting kicked out of class? I said she wanted to see my schedule, but she only picked me because I was the only black person in the class. She was like, well, we need to call your parent. I'm doing something so you can have a seat. And so I walked out and I sat here on the stairs and I sat there for like the entire period.
She didn't cry, but she was upset. Keisha kind of wanted to change schools, maybe go to Rainier Beach where her friends were, but she stuck it out. Even though the pain of that first day has lingered. And Keisha persevered in the honors classes, but it was not easy being one of two black students.
Just culturally, white kids just talk about different things than black kids. I mean, it was just, you know, white people talking about going on skiing, going to Crystal Mountain. I had no idea where Crystal Mountain was, and, you know, coming in puffy jackets and your need to code switch and, you know, what my family calls maybe using your white voice a little bit, you know.
I think it was very dislocating for her and really, you know, in hindsight, I would say it probably gave her a strong ability to fight for what she cares about today.
Sasha Rabkin became friends with Keisha sophomore year at Garfield.
She was fighting from a very early age to claim her space in education in a way that students shouldn't have to do.
Sasha had almost a mirror opposite experience at the school. He was one of the few white students in the regular non-honors classes. He says that was rewarding and gave him a diverse group of friends. And in the weird way that careers intersect, Keisha and Sasha now work on the same issues. He works for the nonprofit Equal Opportunity Schools, which helps districts desegregate their advanced classes. He says Keisha's isolation as a Black student in mostly white honors and AP classes, that's what happens all across the country.
Consistently, we see that African American, Latino, students of color in advanced courses feel like they don't belong. So I think for Keisha, both from her own experience and from what she knows about education now, it was a very challenging experience, but one that very clearly lit a fire under her that has not extinguished.
Would these stairs have been the same then?
Yeah, all the stairs are the same. You see they have the original woodwork. And, oh yeah, okay, I remember it was up here, science.
Which you love, right?
I love science. I majored in science.
Keisha has conflicted feelings about Garfield High School. It was hard being racially isolated, but she has a lot of good memories, too. She took classes like genetics and marine science, and she started to forge her identity as a young Black woman. But the lengths she went to do that are eye-opening. Junior year, she opted to take two U.S. history classes with the same teacher, one advanced placement and the other regular U.S. history. That way, she could learn the advanced material and have class with her Black friends. She had to explain it to the teacher when she went to sign up.
He's like, you already have U.S. history. You know, what are you taking this class for? That's not at your level. You're taking the, you know, the AP U.S. history. I said, I just love U.S. history, Mr. Creighton.
For college, Keisha chose an historically Black university in Atlanta. She majored in chemistry and had fun. She even jumped on stage at a Tupac concert during homecoming. She graduated and came back to Seattle to work as a hazardous materials manager for Boeing. But it was kind of boring work. She kept thinking about teaching. She had a newborn baby, but decided to keep working full-time at Boeing and pursue a master's in teaching. She became a middle school math and science teacher and then a principal. Now, she's working on fixing the racial equity problems she saw back when she was a student. And it's a very interesting time to be doing that. Superintendent Denise Juno has put this issue front and center. She uses striking language to talk about Garfield's lack of diversity in advanced classes.
I heard that the students there called it the slave ship or apartheid high. Since that time, I have learned that this is a generational legacy. This program segregation has been endorsed by this district for generations. This is unacceptable and embarrassing.
So Juno has taken aim at the idea of separate classes for gifted kids. Her idea of sending most of the kids back to their neighborhood schools is pretty unpopular with parents of kids in the advanced program. They've been speaking up at school board meetings. They say the problem is not the separate classes. It's the convoluted testing system. It creates barriers for kids of color.
Getting rid of dedicated HCC schools will amount to inefficiencies in teaching.
In the spirit of fixing equity issues, don't throw out what is working for an ill-defined alternative. Focus on identification. The testing is horrible.
He no longer complains that he's bored at school. He no longer asks me to email his teacher to give him more challenges.
When you ask people to suspend their privilege, it becomes really hard.
That last voice you heard was Keisha again. This is where racial equity does get really hard. Keisha says it comes down to opportunity hoarding. Families with privilege do a lot to make sure their kids continue to have privilege. But she says this shouldn't be a zero-sum game. If one group of kids isn't thriving, it hurts all of us. For example, Keisha says we need to rethink how we use the term gifted.
What I'd like to posit is, how do we think about access for all students? And what if we were to reframe that all of our children are highly capable and gifted, because they are. They're all highly capable of things, and they need just the opportunity.
Keisha says the best solution is to integrate students and provide them all access to challenging material. As a student, she succeeded in Seattle schools, but she's well aware that for many students of color, the system has not worked.
Education is not just a moral responsibility. It is a matter of life or death. I mean, when you look at health equity outcomes, particularly in communities of color, we have to all figure this out, you know, together.
The urgency has only increased over 30 years without progress. She says this is just too important to get wrong.
Ashley Gross covers youth and education on KNKX. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is a work in progress. Susan Liu's ongoing project is coming to grips with the central event of her childhood. That's meant trying to better understand her Vietnamese family, and especially her mother, Jennifer Ha.
Mom was mega mom. She was super mom, right? Like, she was the maternal figure that helped sponsor everyone over. I mean, we bought a house 8 years after immigrating to America. You know, my dad had eventually had a gardening business. My mom had her nail salon. All the family worked there. They were living that American dream. And I would say, yes, it was led by my mom.
Jennifer Ha died when Susan was 11 years old. Susan has spent much of her adult life trying to get to know her mother, even though the Vietnamese elders in the family, following tradition, won't talk about her. Susan lives in West Seattle, but she grew up in Santa Rosa, California. From the very beginning, Susan was part of the family businesses, especially her mother's salon.
From when I was about probably 5 or 6, on the weekends, I would get to go to the nail salon, and my job was to entertain the customers. I was taking off their nail polish, and I'd make them tea and coffee and go feed their meter and take change, and I would confirm appointments. We didn't have daycare. We didn't have summer camp. We had the nail salon. And at that point, it's about 1994, my mom has sponsored over her three sisters and her grandparents and a cousin, and we all live in the same house together with my three siblings. And there are always people flowing in and out of our house. So it's about 13 people in a 4-bedroom house. It's kind of like Brady Bunch, but for Vietnamese refugees. My sister and I shared a bed. There was a bunk bed with my aunts. There was another bed with two older women sharing a bed. So we were about 6 people in 1 bedroom. And this was very normal for me. You know, we would eat, always communal style, always Vietnamese food. And I would eat all my favorite foods. I would keep eating my favorite foods until the point where people were like, you know, you should really stop. Because if you get too fat, no one's ever going to love you. And this was a recurring phrase that folks always said to me, my elders, my Vietnamese elders. And I had no idea that my mom also faced these pressures of feeling that love was conditional, that feeling that if her ao yai didn't look perfect on her body, that she wasn't enough. And I think it was perhaps, you know, having 4 kids, sitting down in her nail salon chair all day, not really having time for exercise or leisure. She worked 6-7 days a week. I had no idea that my mom also didn't love herself as she was, that she wanted to change herself. The day was Friday, September 27th, 1996. And I was 11 years old, and I really wanted to go to 6th grade volleyball tryouts. That morning, I was in the kitchen getting ready. I was up very early, and my mom was also up very early. She's asking me where I'm going. I'm telling her I'm going to go to volleyball tryouts, and she told me I can't. You know, you got to focus on school. But Ma, I'm the best student in the class. My teacher told me I'm the best student. I don't care. We don't have money for the uniforms. And I was so mad at her. I looked at her and I told her I hated her. And my mom and dad are getting into the car. I'm not sure why they're leaving so early. And I slammed the garage door. I'm just like, I hate you. What I didn't know is they were going to a plastic surgery clinic to a doctor that they found in the weekly Vietnamese newspaper. He had placed all these ads saying he had volunteered in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. So everyone thought he was a good guy. My mom went in for a tummy tuck, the narrowing of her nostrils, and a chin implant. And About 2 hours in, she loses oxygen to her brain. She was without oxygen for 14 minutes before the doctor made the 911 call. And then my brother made the decision to pull the plug. Because she was too far gone. And that was the first day of the rest of my life. When my mom was alive, everyone was making food and my dad was singing karaoke and it was just amazing. We were a proud Vietnamese family. And families would come over on the weekends and it was always this big, amazing gathering. And after my mom died, that all went away very quickly. Now instead of 13 people in a 4-bedroom house, there's 3 people in a 4-bedroom house. We're Vietnamese, and so there isn't this sense of like grief counseling and hugs and processing and checking in. Right? There's this Vietnamese phrase, bỏ qua đi, throw it away and let it go. And everyone just needed to move on. And I would continuously ask, what was mom like and what happened, and tell me more. And everyone just said, bỏ qua đi. There were still the 5 of us, but we never talked about it. And we still haven't talked about it. I was in my second year in business school, and all of my professors kept talking about the world is your oyster. If you want something, go pivot your career, go make it happen. If I can have anything, what do I really want? So it's late at night, I'm doing a stats problem set, and then I realize, how did that guy get away with killing my mom? He lost his license for 4 years. We didn't get any money from him because he didn't have malpractice insurance. And he continued to practice for the rest of his life. But it wasn't just my mom. There was 24 other lawsuits. And I think that's what had really aggravated me, because he had targeted Vietnamese people with his ads. Hired a Vietnamese translator, 30% of his clientele was Vietnamese. That was what was aggravating, because they had no idea what they were walking into. And then I wondered, is he still alive? Is he still doing this to more women? And then I became obsessed. He was still alive. He was practicing in Alameda, and there were other lawsuits. So I realized, with all this power and privilege, I could finally do something. I had a specialization in marketing, so it became very clear to me. You know, I was going to do targeted Facebook ads. I was going to pay for billboards by his clinic, so to shame him, and then find local journalists to write an expose in him in the East Bay Express. It was very clear to me what I needed to do. And about a month before I was going to execute this campaign, I found out he died. So I'm facing a wall, and I feel like there's nothing I can do. So I kind of forget about it. You know, I move on with life. But it's on my wedding day in 2015, where it's very obvious my mom is not there, that I realize I still miss her. That I realize I don't know her. And that I realize I need to know her. So I started going on this journey. I keep asking my very stubborn family more questions. I start digging through thousands of pages of depositions. I was going through the medical board decision for the doctor, and it said, it was unusual that Jennifer Ha said that she was 110 pounds in all her documents, when really she was 140 pounds. And reading that one evening, I started to sob. I started crying because I'm 140 pounds. My mom's body and my body are the same. It's the same structure. If we were paper dolls and you put our bodies on top of each other, they would fit. So here I am spending years trying to figure out who my mom was, and then all of a sudden I realize the very thing that I hated all the time is the very gift that my mom left behind. I have her body, and that's right here. And through all this, I don't have any anger for the doctor anymore. I actually don't have any sadness that she's gone. I feel this life-giving sense of liberation and healing. Because I know her, I feel close to her. And through our story together, we provide a sense of lightness and love to other people. Because everyone experiences suffering. Everyone has had pain, whether that's, you know, loss or being an immigrant or hating your body because of what people have said to you. We all experience suffering. It's universal. But the question is what do we do with that suffering? Do we give it care and attention? Do we put it under the rug? What are we going to do with it?
That story was produced by Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. Susan Liu explores her family's history in a one-woman show called 140 Pounds. She's on a 10-city tour right now. It comes to Seattle's ACT Theater in February. To learn more, go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and today's stories each involve a work in progress. When you're young and in college, just about everything feels like it's in flux. Your identity itself is unfinished. Well, a few months ago, Sound Effect producer Jennifer Wing made a trip to the top of a ridge in eastern Washington near Ellensburg to a spot where young adults are working out who they're going to be. Monastash Ridge Observatory is an unusual place. Massive scientific instruments are usually reserved for professionals, but here, undergraduates from the University of Washington are in charge of the observatory's giant telescope. That trust and that freedom give the young people a chance to make discoveries about both the heavens and themselves. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing takes it from here.
The Monastash Ridge Observatory, or MRO, sits on top of this huge stretch of Earth that pops out of the surrounding landscape of flat Timothy hayfields. The ridge is actually an earthquake fault line, one of several in this part of the state. Getting to the observatory involves a white-knuckle drive on a road full of rocks, a creek, and at least one washout. Luckily, I'm driving in an old Jeep Cherokee with high clearance. Parker Miles Blom, the station's photographer, who also knows how to change a tire, is in the passenger seat.
Wow, look at that. There's a truck down there that hit a tree.
Wait, seriously?
Like
there's a.
It looked like an old 80s pickup. It had been smashed into a tree. The doors, windows, everything are gone.
Wow. Hopefully that won't be us. We arrive at the top in one piece. And since it's summer and early evening, there's still a lot of light. We're almost 4,000 feet up. We enter the whitewashed building. Most of the lower level feels like a bunker. 21-year-old Megan Kokoris and 26-year-old Mercedes Thompson, who are both studying physics and astronomy, give us a quick tour.
Don't drink the tap water. It's collected outside. Where do I still go in that room? It smells really bad.
What's the source of the smell?
Mice. They had a mama mouse take refuge.
We head upstairs to the living room and kitchen area. Parker and I brought up two pizzas to share with the four students.
This is where me, Sonia, and Mercedes sleep. So Sonia and Zach.
Hi.
One wall is mostly windows. It's truly a bird's eye view. Mount Stewart is off to the left, Ellensburg down to the right. Sleeping bags are spread out on the big sofa. There's a TV and a record player. This place is like overnight camp or a fancy treehouse for astronomy students, except the food. It's so much better. 20-year-old Sonia Delcasol, another dual physics and astronomy major, goes over the menu.
So right now we're making wontons with like tofu, carrots, napa cabbage, and mushrooms. We also have stir-fried green beans with scrambled eggs on top and ginger and garlic.
Yeah, are you guys hungry?
Yeah, well, we brought the pizza. This is so much better than the pizza.
You should eat with us.
But I don't want to take any food away from you guys.
No, eat with us.
Megan and Mercedes continue the tour and save the best for last. They lead the way into the cavernous room that holds the telescope. The instrument is a large white cylinder hanging from the ceiling.
So this is our telescope. So just be careful not to hit your head or hit any wires.
Yeah, be mindful of the wires.
Yeah.
They open the dome. Back in 1972, when this place was first built, everything here was state-of-the-art. Today, it's a bit obsolete. Over the decades, telescopes went from being operated in person to being manipulated remotely by computers. This observatory is now mostly used to teach astronomy students like Megan.
So it's cool going from remotely using a telescope to actually being hands-on, controlling it here.
And just because this telescope is old doesn't mean it hasn't had any updates. Megan holds up an Xbox controller. This is what opens the enormous dome and moves the telescope around. As the sun gets lower in the sky, the telescope is pointing at zenith.
Zenith means it's pointing straight above us. So from zenith, we can go to the RA and declination, which is basically the latitude and longitude of the stars. And so it's not at zenith. It doesn't know where to go.
We make our way out onto the roof.
You can hold on to this.
This?
Yeah, that's
okay.
This is beautiful. Yeah, it's fun. The wind farm will start blinking red at night. It's also, you're lucky that it's this week because you're going to be able to see the Milky Way out tonight.
Yeah.
I love telling people about space.
Why?
Oh, it's amazing.
Megan and Mercedes get really excited talking about astronomy and how they're able to learn so much about space by using instruments like this telescope, which is essentially a giant light catcher.
You're literally collecting light, and to be able to find the distance, the temperature, what is in the atmosphere of the star, the type of the star, how old it is, how long it's going to live, if there are planets around it, so many things. And that's just with like stars. It's amazing to be able to learn all that stuff just by collecting light.
Yeah, I definitely, it is a really cool connection because I don't think most people get a lot of chance to be like that close to something that far away.
Like last night, we had some extra time. We decided to look at a spiral galaxy. So, you know, it's like our Milky Way. So it's what you think of as a galaxy. And we look through the finder scope, you know, you can't see anything. And you take an image and there's this amazing like spiral with all these arms, the big like core that you can see.
Tonight, they'll be collecting images of stars to learn if their light varies. Megan and Mercedes start talking about how the universe is accelerating and expanding and how the Milky Way will someday collide with Andromeda, and I'm trying to keep up with them.
I don't know if you were taught this, but the raisin bread analogy, you have bread, dough, and you put raisins in it, and as it bakes, everything expands and gets farther apart. And that's basically what's happening to our universe.
I think one of my favorite, like, I feel like studying you really realize, like, how unique being able to exist really is. By one of our professors, Brownlee, he had this fact, if I'm remembering it correctly, it was like, if intelligent life is not within the 100 closest stars to us, based on the speed limit of the speed of light, they will never physically be able to reach us because the universe is expanding so much that they'll never be able to close the distance between us and them.
We wait for the sun to go down, and we eat the delicious meal. Mercedes shares more about the culture of this place, which veers in directions that have nothing to do with science and everything to do with being silly and juvenile.
If you're on a trip where there's another group coming after you, we always try and prank each other. Mm-hmm. So the group before us made all these, like, butt drawings. There's like a drawing in the control room right now that's MRO with, like, human legs and a butt.
Cleaning up after dinner, someone asks Mercedes about a new ring on her left hand. Mercedes shares the news that her longtime partner proposed and that she said yes.
What?
When the students aren't gathering data and working with the telescope, they're sharing moments like this that are the building blocks for an adult life. However, youth still has a stronghold. Keeping in tune with the whole sleepaway camp vibe here, they have deep conversations when they're tucked into their sleeping bags.
Just about, like, as astronomers, like, some of the questions that you kind of just have to accept of, like, A, how small you are, B, how, like, everything you do is, in the end, kind of irrelevant, because it's, like, and if you, like, look on such large time scales, it can, you know, your life is, like, just this tiny blip. But then at the same time, like, how freeing that was to all of us, of where it, like, kind of, like, it kind of relieves this, like, pressure of existence almost, because it's just like, well, it doesn't matter what I do, so I'm just going to do what I want and, like, try and make that the most meaningful thing that I can to myself.
Before heading back down the horrible road, this time in the dark, we all go outside to look up at the sky. The Milky Way stretches out above us. The dome of the observatory is open. The red lights from inside make it look like a giant white pizza oven that's on fire. It's only 10 o'clock. The peak hours for the students to study the sky are between 11:30 and 2:30 in the morning. Their heads won't hit pillows until 4 a.m. For them, the night is still very young.
That story from Sound Effects' Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today on Sound Effect is Work in Progress. We're about to meet someone who has reinvented herself in a pretty major way. If you went back in time and told 14-year-old Grace Sullivan that she'd grow up to study biology, she probably wouldn't know what you were talking about. Grace grew up in a house connected with a religious commune, a closed community in Tacoma that some, including Grace herself, consider a cult. We're declining to name it out of concern for family members who remain a part of it. Absolute submission was required, she says. Children to parents, wives to husbands, all men to the church leaders. It was an especially challenging place for kids to grow up. But it did offer something that Grace desperately wanted, acceptance.
When I was very young, like probably under 10, it all felt really great and special. And I was really eager to get it right and to be in. But things can get really serious really fast, and you could be pulled into a meeting or for a correction by any adults at any time. So I would go into a room and have me stand on a chair and turn off the lights and close the blinds and be surrounded by a circle of leaders, adults, you know, and I would be maybe 13 or 14 or so, and they're just yelling. You are sinful, you are hellbound, you are garbage. Random phrases and words, and it's sort of like improvisation. Like, it's my job to respond back to them without thinking and to submit to everything they say. So I think the goal was to get you to stop thinking at all. And it could be something silly, like, you know, a leader saying, I'm telling you that the sky is yellow. What color is the sky? The sky is yellow. And your response has to be really fast. And those could go on for hours, and you're trying not to lose your balance. I was fairly low status because my dad had stopped going, and so I would say that my sisters and I were probably at the bottom. It was the result of a public shaming, so sort of like the chair circle thing, but on stage at church. I always got the impression that he felt like he just couldn't hack it. He wasn't good enough for the commune, but it wasn't a strong stance of, this place is bad and it's harming my family. It was I'm just not cut out for this. Then once like 12 and 13 hits, there's very, very specific paths for boys to go down and for girls to go down. So I would be sort of in a group of young girls, and we'd be trimming a hedge and doing a bunch of yard work while the boys are off playing basketball and doing their thing. Or they'd be able to sit in a circle with the men and talk about spiritual things. And that was not a place where women were welcome. So we just went to being homeschooled by my mom, and you're preparing for a life of motherhood and service. She focused on a lot of quilting, crocheting and knitting, sewing her own clothes, grinding her own wheat for flour, baking bread, cooking, making preserves, growing a vegetable garden, harvesting fruit, training animals, butchering animals, and studying the Bible really, really thoroughly. We read through the Bible several times. And eventually the Tacoma group formed their own kind of homeschool co-op, I guess I'll call it. And my mom helped them form that. But then when it was time to start school, the leadership forbade my sisters and I from attending because our father wasn't in submission to the leadership. So I think I was probably about 11 or 12 when that happened, and I was really distraught. Everything was ultimately aimed towards creating people who will say yes to their leadership and who will always doubt their inner intuition. I remember reaching a point for about 6 months or a year where I was furious that I was a girl. I wanted to be a boy so badly because I started seeing my own path becoming narrower and narrower, but I didn't know what to do with those feelings of like, this isn't right. I'm smart. I want to have cool spiritual conversations with the leaders, and all during this time, I still felt very much like in love with the ideas of the commune. And it wasn't until I was just turning 16 that I finally had an epiphany. My older sisters were so cool, like really cool. Volkswagen van, driving around the country, smoking pot, listening to Bob Marley. Like, it's very, very hard to stay in a religious cult when you have such awesome, cool older siblings. They also left when they were teenagers. I started getting really close to my oldest sister during around the time I was around 15. She was preparing to get married, and I lived with her for a couple months, helping her get ready for that and getting to know her as a person, watching X-Files, and just getting a little bit of a taste of life away from all that judgment and shame and like heaviness. And then around the time of my sister's wedding, there was a really, it's not worth going into the details, but the community did something really cruel to my sister at her wedding. She had tried to sort of extend the olive branch to them, and the next morning at church, the leadership women were laughing with my mother about how they'd taught her a lesson, and one day she'll come back and we'll all have a good laugh about this. I remember thinking like, oh, this sort of behavior made sense to me before when I didn't know who these people were who were getting treated this way because they were outside of the group. But now I know my sister and I know where she's coming from. You can't do that to my sister. And I remember the laughter of the leadership women. I just knew in that moment that I was standing in a place of incredible cruelty that had nothing good for me and nothing good for my future. And I walked out, and my twin sister and my younger sister trickled out as well, and we all kind of sat quietly in the van. I remember there was sort of this moment of like, do we say this out loud? And I don't remember exactly what I said, but I think it was something like, I'm never coming back here again. And we were all three in the same boat, and we never did. My mom had a brother who was a really wonderful person, and when he passed away, he left my parents a little bit of money. My dad took that as a sort of maybe sign from God that he could finally retire, and he decided to move to Hawaii. So my mom, acting out of submission, followed him there. So that was when I was 18, my parents left. And I had a younger sister as well who was 16. And my parents had rented the house we grew up in, so my sisters and I just sort of stayed there. But shockingly, about 2 or 3 months into them being gone, we got an eviction notice that the land was being developed into apartment buildings, and we had 3 days to get out. Ended up renting a house in the hilltop of Tacoma and moving into the city. The house was sort of a ramshackle, mostly heated by one wood stove in the main floor, and so we'd chop wood, and you know, we were very, very short on food. We felt pretty great, honestly. It was a huge improvement. So I got married young and had 2 children in my 20s, and really loved my life. But I had always wanted to go to school, and my kids were getting older, and I thought, probably way too late to start, and I'm super intimidated. You know, I think we probably all do this. We go through life parroting phrases that we've been parroting for a long time, and then one day we wake up and hear ourselves saying it and think, I don't actually think I believe that anymore. My good friend was giving me a haircut and, you know, checking in about life and chatting and talked about the idea of school, and I said, yeah, I don't want to spend 4 years working really hard on something and then you just have a dumb piece of paper to show for it. And I realized when it was coming out of my mouth that that was just my parents talking. That was the commune. That's not really what I believed. And my friend said, well, Grace, 4 years are going to go by no matter what you do. What are you going to have to show for it? It was like I started allowing myself to believe that I could go to college. So I decided to enroll in Tacoma Community College. I started out in a math class and a psychology class, and I can't explain enough how scary it was and how much self-doubt I had. For that first psychology class, I copied the textbook into a notebook twice because I wasn't sure what I was supposed to know or how to be strategic in my learning. And I basically would go and be in my classes and then go sit out in my car. I was really uncomfortable going to the cafeteria or the library or even just being around other students. I have always felt that there's just a giant stamp on my forehead, which is homeschooled and grew up in a cult, and that I can't get around it. My mind just came alive in college. I didn't seek out a degree in molecular and cellular biology. I was just genuinely curious when I started learning about microbiology and looking through the microscope. I had a similar sensation to maybe looking up at the night sky for the first time, and this just very dramatic sense of perspective. And microbiology is the field where there are so many unanswered questions. This idea that the body of knowledge was still growing, and it was being grown by people who were curious, who were analytical, and who were asking questions. All things that were not safe for me to do as a kid growing up, but that I'm actually very good at. I come from a background of very magical thinking, very angels and demons and heaven and hell, and not really viewing myself as an animal or as like a part of this natural system. Like, I didn't know what an atom was or an electron or these really concrete, this is what things are made out of and this is how it works. I didn't have anything like that. And so the more I learned, the more I felt like everything was beautiful and complex and reassuring, and I felt more and more a part of this world and less caught up worrying about eternity anymore.
Grace Sullivan graduated with a Bachelor of Science from the University of Puget Sound. Among other things, she's a climate activist and a musician. You can hear her latest musical project, X Dreams, at our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. And we did contact the religious organization in the story for comment, but they declined to do so. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner, with help this week from Ashley Gross and Kari Plogue. Our executive producer is Florangela Davila. You can find our free podcast on NPR One, Spotify, and all the other places, including your smart speaker. Just say, play the podcast Sound Effect. Leave us a review on iTunes and send feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when our theme is Getting There. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.